as though still trying to figure us out. It occurs to me that maybe his foreign language skills aren't so acute in the dull light of sobriety. But his silence is nevertheless curious, considering how chatty he'd been the night before. Perhaps his decision to remain silent betrays a fear that he has said too much already. Indeed, in the coming weeks, we'll spot him several more times, both at the hotel and around town, but he'll never make an effort to speak to us again. More usually, he'll do his best to keep a distance. It is one of the anomalous traditions or rules of North Korean travel that you never eat breakfast with your guides. Maybe it's because, in Pyongyang especially, the perpetually empty hotels have been built with so many restaurants that they have to come up with reasons to use them. Or maybe it's to restrict the Koreans from taking part in the lavish buffet offerings of Chinese, Korean, and Western food items that the foreigners are treated to. Anyway, after dining in the Hulk Parterre, we walk down the stairs to meet Min and Ro in the lobby. Min is still confused as to what to do with the day's itinerary we no longer want to follow. It's the standard tourist schlock we've all done. Interesting for first-timers, but boring for repeat offenders. As every museum and historical site is guided with the same venerational spiel about its significance to the life narrative of Kim Il-sung and or Kim Jong-il. Today, we were meant to visit the Tower of the Jucha Idea, which each of us has done two or three times. Yesterday, Min's face had a look of confused, mild panic when Alec told her in the car that we wanted to make some minor adjustments to the itinerary. Since each site has its own guide, all arrangements have to be made well in advance, and for certain places, advance permission must first be granted. Spontaneity is all but impossible in the DPRK. As Min waffles, Alexander suggests we first journey to Mansu Hill to lay flowers at the Grand Monument, the statues of the leaders. At that, Min perks up, relieved. "Yes, let's do that," she agrees. "And afterward, why don't we go to the new water park? You can have some fun before class starts tomorrow. Did you bring your bathing suits?" In order to understand anything about North Korea, past, present, or future, one must have a good understanding of Kim Jong-un's grandfather, Kim Il-sung. But in order to gain that understanding, one must comb through an absurdly reverential state-sanctioned hagiography whose supposed truths consist of wild exaggeration, when not blatant fabrication. Add to that challenge the outlandish rumors and obfuscations that have been generated outside the country, often by foreign media and government agencies, over the years, many taking the form of sensationalized and unsubstantiated reports of events that no one has bothered or been able to confirm or contest. As though the world's worst country isn't deserving of the dignity of truth. North Korea's ultranationalist ideology, shocking and incomprehensible though it may appear today, is rooted in the country's unique post-colonial situation. At the Cairo Conference in 1943, Winston Churchill, Chiang Kai-shek, and Franklin Roosevelt together decided that after Japan's defeat, the country should lose all of the colonies it had gained by force, including Korea. Simultaneously, toward the end of the Second World War, the Soviets promised their American allies to contribute to the Pacific Front following the defeat of Nazi Germany. In Korea, the Soviets swiftly gained so much ground that the U.S. government began to worry they might soon control the entire peninsula. Pressed for time, on August 8, 1945, two young officers, Dean Rusk and Charles Bonesteel, neither of whom had ever been to Korea or knew anything about the country, were handed a map of the peninsula ripped out of a National Geographic article. They had 30 minutes to divide it. The officers made their mark across the 38th parallel, a line that nearly perfectly bisected the peninsula, the benefit being that Seoul fell in the proposed U.S.-controlled southern half. To the surprise of the Americans, the Soviets immediately accepted the proposal, likely out of a more or less equal state of ignorance. Korea's fate was thus sealed by two antagonistic powers that knew nearly nothing about it. If it was the Japanese occupation that spurred the burning desire for independence and the subsequent foundation of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, it was Comrade Kim Il-sung, according to official mythology, who led the guerrilla armed resistance that fought the occupiers off Korean soil and returned the nation to its people. This is not quite accurate, though neither is the oversimplified claim that Kim was immediately installed as leader of North Korea by Stalin. One of the ironies of Korea's division is that there were no communists in North Korea at the time of division. Seoul was the capital of Korea's fledgling communist movement, which had largely been dispersed by the Japanese, so that most Korean communists were in either Manchuria or the Soviet Union at the time of liberation. The reality is that Kim Il-sung was one of many men in Korea who had been imported into the North by the Soviets. At first, he was given a rather modest role, Minister of Defense. While the particulars of his rise have been made cloudy by the obfuscations and veiled maneuvers of Cold War history, Kim's brisk and all but accidental elevation to the top of the ladder within a month of his landing in Wonsan, which he may not have even anticipated, let alone desired, can be attributed to the Soviet military authorities and advisors on the ground in Pyongyang, who were the ones really running the show, up to at least 1949. Driving to Mansu Hill takes you into the heart of downtown Pyongyang, through the new luxury high-rise apartment cluster, including one building that appears to be a near replica of New York's Trump Plaza, that expats have sardonically dubbed Dubai. As we pull off the main stretch, our route takes us past the imposing marble brutalism of the Mansudae Assembly Hall, where the rubber-stamped parliament congregates once a year. Foreign guests arrive at a side parking lot, where a flower vendor sits in a small hut. We buy a bouquet, and then begin the procession up the small sidewalk to patriotic music piped in on hidden speakers, setting the somber mood for what is, in essence, a mourning ritual undertaken by millions of Koreans each year. The surrounding park is immaculately maintained by volunteer citizens, its blades of grass cut with scissors. The approach to the statues is empty today, save for a lone teenage boy in a young pioneer scarf sweeping the steps with a twig broom. Mansu Hill is, without a doubt, the centerpiece of Pyongyang, geographically, politically, spiritually. In 1972, in honor of his father's 60th birthday, the most important in Confucianism's tradition of filial reverence, Kim Jong-il had a 72-foot bronze statue of the great leader erected at the crest of the hill, overlooking all of Pyongyang. 5 years later, the statue was enriched with gold leaf, but the plating was soon stripped off to its original bronze after a state visit by Deng Xiaoping, who, upon seeing it, expressed concern over how Chinese aid money was being spent. Since then, it has become a custom for Koreans to pay homage by laying flowers at the foot of the statue and bowing. A week before my first visit to the country in 2012, Kim Jong-un had attended an unveiling ceremony at Mansu Hill, where a revised version of his grandfather's likeness had been installed alongside a second statue, one of his recently deceased father, Kim Jong-il. The original statue of Kim Il-sung presented to the world a younger portrayal of the great leader, with an open trench coat revealing the Mao suit that he wore early on, his right arm outstretched to the heavens, and the stern, determined expression on his face denoting unwavering commitment. The revised statue replaces the Mao suit with the formal suit and tie he would don in later years, the rugged revolutionary having been transformed into the respectable world leader, and presents a warm smile on his face, with a pair of spectacles completing the grandfatherly image of the eternal president. His son, the dear leader Kim Jong-il, stands next to him, an equally warm smile animating his features. A smile, it must be said, virtually absent from all official photographic documentation. As he stares out over the horizon of the country he and his father ruled for more than half a century. The statues are works of epic kitsch. laughably repulsive, with their cartoonishly blocky shapes approximating the two men's girthy stature. Loud and tacky with their bronze pseudo-sheen. Still, you would be foolish to laugh here. This, after all, is the most sacred site in all of North Korea. It is here where you are told, prior to your arrival, and again by your guides, who will likely be staring over your shoulder as you raise your camera, that the entirety of the sculptures, from head to foot, must be captured in any photographs taken. Close-ups of any details of the leaders' bodies are strictly forbidden. The icons are backgrounded with one of North Korea's most famous mosaics, by Park Po-sik and Moon Gi-song, rendering in beige, white, and gray Lake Chon, the volcanic water body nestled in the caldera atop Mount Paektu. Considered to be the most sacred mountain in all of Korea by northerners and southerners alike. The mosaic encompasses some 230 feet of the back wall of the Korean Revolution Museum, whose contents tell the story of the country from its founding to the present day. "Travis, can you remove your sunglasses, please?" Min asks. Fuck. I've already made a gaffe, and it's only our second day. The sunglasses. Of course. I quickly snatch them off my head and return my arms to the sides of my body, staring unblinking ahead at the two daunting figures before me. Why Kim Il-sung? What did the Soviets see in him? Documents from the Soviet archives imply that they had few, if any, real plans for North Korea following the Second World War. It was an afterthought. They were improvising. They may have even considered letting the Americans take control of the entire peninsula at one point, so vague was their interest. Though Korea does share a border with Russia, so that was one reason not to let that happen. Same reason why China today has no real interest in a South Korean-led reunification. Nobody wants American troops at their border. In such murky environs, where disinterest runs high, unusual events tend to unfold. Kim caught the attention of the Pyongyang-based Soviet advisors early on. Had he arrived in Pyongyang a few weeks later, it's probable that his name would have been lost to history. Clearly, he was seen as a good tactical intermediary between Moscow and the local populace. After all, he had spent the past two decades in exile in the Soviet Union and spoke passable Russian. Even though, with his eighth grade education, he was by no stretch of the imagination a great intellectual. Many of his Soviet counterparts found his comprehension of the teachings of Marx and Lenin to be embarrassingly paltry. Still, great thinkers weren't required or even particularly desired in the Soviet bloc in those years. Obedience was the quality most sought after. And Kim had kept his distance from the clique of professional revolutionaries and apparatchiks that Stalin had so grown to despise, a factor that increased his worth in the generalissimo's eyes. What's more, he had actually been born in Pyongyang, which is where the new capital was, and was famous among many Koreans for his guerrilla exploits against the Japanese. Though these exploits would soon come to be so exaggerated and distorted in the official propaganda as to appear unrecognizable to anyone with an intimate knowledge of Kim's actual activities prior to his return to Korea on that hot autumn day in 1945. Kim, it was decided, would make the perfect puppet. He was born in the present-day Pyongyang district of Manyongdae in 1912. On the same day the Titanic went down, April 15th. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why Titanic would later become one of his son's favorite films. A North Korean remake, produced at Kim Jong-il's behest, would later tank, or, if you prefer, sink, on the international festival circuit. His birth name, the name he was known by until he changed it in the 1930s, was Kim Song-ju. National myth ascribes his background to the poor, oppressed peasantry, though in actuality his family was moderately well-to-do by the standards of the day, with a schoolteacher father deeply ensconced in the Presbyterian Church. Like many families, the Kims resented the Japanese occupation of the country, and moved to Manchuria, a hotbed of the anti-Japanese movement where 2 million Koreans resided. In 1932, when the Japanese launched a military offensive in the region to further extend their colony, resistance was fierce. Among those to respond to the attacks was 20-year-old Kim, who organized his first guerrilla unit. Though his middle-class background would have set him on course to become a clerk or businessman, Kim, angered by injustice and emboldened by revolutionary fervor, would make a name for himself in a major battle when his ragtag unit managed to save the life of Chinese commander Shi Chung-hung. From that moment on, Kim became a confidant of prominent Chinese officers active in the region's battlefront. The rebellion was soon quashed, and the Japanese puppet state of Manchukuo came into existence. Though resistance continued, led by the local Chinese Communist Party, which, despite its name, consisted largely of Koreans opposed to the Japanese colonizers. Koreans like Kim and his cohorts. By 1936, the resistance had fomented into a formidable Sino-Korean army, with Kim commanding the 3rd Division. He would spend much of the last half of the 1930s in combat. Far from being the single force fighting off the Japanese that North Korean propaganda eulogizes him as, Kim's was but one of a number of scrappy units staging random attacks on the Japanese with wavering success. Subsequent exaggerations aside, his activities were brave and heroic, and his leadership role was clear enough for the Japanese to issue a bounty for his head. After a devastating defeat in 1940, Kim and his surviving comrades were no longer safe in Manchuria. They had little choice but to flee to safety in the Soviet Union. There, the Korean guerrillas were enlisted in the Red Army, undergoing training for the next few years in anticipation of the Soviet war with Japan. Kim became a major. But when that battle finally erupted in the final days of the Second World War in 1945, victory came so quick that Kim's unit didn't even get a chance to fight. Though that didn't stop North Korea from claiming that victory as Kim's alone. For the official history of the period that followed, you can visit the Workers' Party Foundation Museum in central Pyongyang, not far from the Koryo Hotel. Housed in what is touted to be Kim Il-sung's office in the first years following the liberation from Japan, the modest two-story structure, constructed in the early 1920s, is a rare surviving example of colonial architecture. Blocky and imposing, the building sports a small domed rooftop, a minor riff on the Tokyo Imperial Diet Building's central tower. The ground floor exhibit tells the story of the creation of the Workers' Party, the country's ruling political faction, while the second floor preserves the president's offices and a meeting hall, which contains, astonishingly, busts of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Stalin, images of whom have been deleted elsewhere in the propaganda stream. Here you will learn that, practically the moment he vacated the womb, Kim Il-sung was already at work on the blueprints for the Korean Workers' Party. In actuality, the first Korean Communist Party was founded secretly in 1925 in Seoul, many miles away from the teenage Kim, who would have no feasible means of knowing of its existence, and was dissolved within 3 years as a result of infighting and pressure from the Japanese colonial overlords. You are taught that Kim's original Juche doctrine was always at the heart of the Workers' Party ideology. Another blatant fabrication. The concept of Juche wasn't introduced into the North Korean lingo until the 1950s, only to be later significantly expounded upon by neither Kim nor his son, but by Hwang Jong-yup, the North Korean state's official ideologue in the 1970s and 1980s. Another thing your guide at the Workers' Party Foundation Museum will neglect to mention, because in all probability she is unaware of it herself, is that Kim was actually a member of the Chinese Communist Party throughout his time in Manchuria. The official foundation of the Workers' Party of North Korea is dated to October 10, 1945. In actuality, that date marked the foundation of the North Korean Bureau of the Communist Party of Korea, a Soviet organization. The founding of the Independent Workers' Party didn't take place until a year later, Though these details matter little, as Kim Il-sung, though not nominally the head of either party or organization at this point, was very much the man at the top from February 1946, less than 6 months after his return to the homeland. The following year, enthuses your guide, a democratic reform took place. It only took 1 year to complete. This democratic reform consisted of many of the processes that will be well familiar to students of communist regimes. Land reform was instituted, albeit in a less bloody fashion than in neighboring China, with many former landowners opting to simply flee to the south, where some were given prized positions in Syng Man Rhee's U.S.-backed police state. The country's main industries, for which the Japanese laid the groundwork, were nationalized. Christians were hunted down and killed or expelled, many fleeing to the south. All this took place with little resistance among the people, unused to participatory politics after having been ruled as colonial subjects, caught up in the dream and promise of independence. Nor did many protest the Soviets' involvement with their early state, as the Soviets were deemed allies, having sided with the Koreans against the despised Japanese. North Korea's foundational ideological platform was essentially more anti-Japanese than it was pro-Soviet. As historian Bruce Cummings has pointed out, the beginning of the official state narrative is always the terrible suffering endured by the Korean people under the spiteful and inherently evil Japanese, followed by the anti-Japanese insurgency led by Kim Il-sung. It is drummed into the brains of everyone in the country, writes Cummings, by an elderly elite that believes anyone younger than they cannot possibly know what it meant to fight Japan in the 1930s, or the United States in the 1950s. For the first time, Koreans could feel what it meant to be part of a sovereign nation in the modern world, with their own language, history, culture, and now, their very own government. The first Congress of the Workers' Party took place on August 28th to the 30th, 1946. This could be regarded as the authentic foundation of the party, the moment when all the disparate communist-affiliated parties then active in North Korea merged into one. There were four main groups of Korean communists imported into the North by the Soviets. A faction that had been exiled in China, the Soviet Koreans, the South Korean communists from Seoul, and finally, Kim Il-sung's gang of guerrilla fighters. Over time, members of all three rival factions would raise objections to the emerging cult of personality surrounding Kim, and to his mismanagement of the economy. Consequentially, all three factions would be violently purged till there was no one left but Kim's former guerrilla comrades, giving rise to the monolithic ideological system of fanaticism surrounding the Kim family. With the Workers' Party in place, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea was formally declared on September 9, 1948. This put an end to the provisional government. Soviet troops and administrators left the country, ceding all power to the Workers' Party. Any mention of Soviet presence in the early days of the DPRK is conspicuously absent from the exhibition at the museum. Like Kim's membership in the Chinese Communist Party, all references to foreign influence have been deleted from official history. No factional intrigue or infighting is noted. What's left, much like in every other such historical museum, is a dull celebration of the brilliant mastermind who single-handedly did everything, Kim Il-sung. By 1949, Kim had already taken on the title of Suryong, a term taken from the Koguryo dynasty, that golden period when Pyongyang was at the center of all things Korean, which meant great leader. A shocking and bold heresy in the Soviet world, where only Stalin was deemed worthy of such a title. But also a clear indication of the new direction North Korea would be taking now that the reins were no longer in the hands of the Soviets. A socialist country in name, a monarchical despot in appearance. To say that the Soviets came to regret their selection of Kim Il-sung to lead the country would be something of an understatement. While the foundations of the North Korean experiment which has now endured for more than 7 decades, were certainly Stalinist. The DPRK would go in an even more extreme direction under Kim's leadership, diverging far from the path prescribed by its Soviet benefactor, which it has now far outlasted. Why? For one thing, it could be that Kim's relations with Stalin and the Soviets were not as rosy as history has simplified them into being. In the end, they underestimated Kim's cunning, for sure. But the Soviets also seemed to lack an understanding of how communism was viewed in Asia. Just as democracy has been practiced in a different way in countries like South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan than it has in the United States, Asian communism has similarly taken different forms. Soviet communism's idealistic roots were in a utopian aspiration towards socioeconomic equality. Its internationalism, workers of the world unite, justifying the Soviets' quasi-imperialist expansion. Asian communists like Mao Zedong, Ho Chi Minh, and Kim Il-sung were first and foremost nationalists. They viewed communism as a way of emancipating their backward countries from colonial enslavement. A vehicle that would accelerate them into the 20th century, modernizing and joining the developed world, while attaining the national sovereignty they so burningly desired. Nowhere was this more the case than in North Korea. Kim's nationalism must have been further incensed by Stalin's harsh treatment of Soviet Koreans. During the Great Purge of the 1930s, Stalin had ordered every Korean Comintern agent to be rounded up and shot, while simultaneously deporting hundreds of thousands of Soviet Korean citizens to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan in a stunning act of ethnic cleansing, on the racist pretext that it was impossible to tell them apart from the Japanese enemy. But Kim was still fully dependent on Stalin up until the Korean War. It is often said that the biggest lie propagated by the DPRK, and the most sacred one, as the entire legitimacy of the country's continual existence is predicated upon an unwavering belief in it, is that the Korean War was started by the U.S.-backed South. Even some leftist South Koreans subscribed to this idea until the Soviet Union itself fell and its archives opened up to reveal a trove of official documents, including correspondence between Stalin and Kim Il-sung, with the North Korean leader imploring his benefactor's permission and support in launching a general invasion, nay, liberation of the southern half of the peninsula. Whether the North was provoked into attacking is another matter. Syngman Rhee issued many incendiary statements at the time, announcing his clear intention to send his soldiers into the northern half of the peninsula, confidently assuring the international media that the process of rescuing the country from the communists would only take a few days. In June 1950, just weeks before the North launched its invasion, soldiers peered through binoculars across the 38th parallel to find prominent U.S. government and military figures on official visits peering back at them. All the more reason to suppose that an attack was in the works. What's more, the Civil War, which is what the Korean War, as it has become known to history, actually was, something that is seemingly forgotten at times by historians, had more or less already erupted in the South in the late 1940s, with violent leftist uprisings against Rhee's oppressive police apparatus, which was widely despised. This does not mean, however, that South Koreans necessarily preferred communist rule, Kim Il-sung style. Nor has the South Korean government's claim that these rebellions were supported by the North ever been substantiated. In a sense, one can say that it matters very little who started the Korean War. It would have broken out regardless, within a matter of weeks or days from that morning of June 24, 1950, when North Korean troops crossed the 38th. Stalin was reluctant to give his assent to a general invasion. This would mean, effectively, declaring war on the United States, the world's sole nuclear superpower at the time, with the memory of Hiroshima still fresh. North Korea was a newly established third-rate client state of the USSR, about which Stalin cared very little. The Soviets well understood the North Koreans' nationalist zeal and were increasingly put off by it, as reports from the Soviet embassy back home to Moscow make clear. Stalin said no to Kim repeatedly. He was far too shrewd to allow a bunch of ultra-nationalist zealots to get him into a deadly war. It would have been suicide. What changed Stalin's mind in the end is that the world began to change. In 1949, the Chinese communists declared victory in their civil war that had erupted not long after China's victory against Japan. Under Mao, the biggest country in the world, and a neighbor of both North Korea and the Soviet Union, was now united beneath the Red Banner. And inside Stalin's own kingdom, the Soviets had managed to successfully test their very own nuclear device. Then, there were the intelligence reports that suggested to Stalin that the United States had no real strategic interest or long-term plans for the situation unfolding on the Korean Peninsula. Perhaps they cared even less than the Soviets about the runty divided country. They were not likely, Stalin now believed, to respond to the North's liberation of the South. Just as, at various moments in the not-so-distant past, Stalin himself had considered letting the entire peninsula go to the Americans. With Kim continuing to rattle at the Soviets' door, Stalin finally gave the nod of approval. Kim had assured Stalin that the war would be won within 3 days. Here, he was relying on his own, no doubt ideologically tainted, intelligence reports that described the Korean people in the South as suffering under a brutal military dictator whom they resented, and assuming that the peasants, upon seeing the Korean People's Army, would immediately throw down their sickles and pick up guns to join the armed revolution against their oppressors. The first part of that report might have been true, but the mass uprising that Kim entertained in his vision of liberation never came to fruition. The 3-day battle he envisioned stretched out into a 3-year-long civil war. The North, in its mangled rewriting of history, has insisted it was somehow both a war of liberation and a war instigated by the United States. It is officially known as the Victorious Fatherland Liberation War. The name poses more than one challenge to the rational mind. If the DPRK was merely defending itself against an attack by a foreign enemy, how could this be a war of liberation? And in what way was this war of liberation victorious, when the end result was not the liberation of the bottom half of the peninsula, but the same division that stood at the war's beginning? At first, the North was poised to win. When the United States-led UN surprised Kim and Stalin by joining the war in September 1950, the North's advance south had been so successful that it was in control of some 95% of the peninsula. The Korean People's Army overwhelmed the Republic of Korea's, ROK, South Korea's official name, in terms of strength, as most of its fighters had fought alongside the communists in the recent Chinese Civil War. If the U.S. had not gotten involved, the war would have been over at that point, with the entire peninsula under the Kim Il-sung dynasty. Indeed, the U.S.'s entry caught Kim Il-sung by surprise. But this was the height of the red-baiting McCarthy era in the United States, and the UN-backed U.S. entry into what would become known as the Forgotten War was a prelude to the U.S.'s subsequent catastrophic attempt to prevent the spread of communism that would be seen in Vietnam. Within a matter of weeks, UN forces, composed mostly of U.S. and South Korean troops, were able to completely reverse the onslaught. The North Korean leadership had to vacate Pyongyang and retreat to the Chinese border. Kim, in a panic, begged Mao to send People's Liberation Army soldiers. Mao, recalling the Koreans' assistance in the Chinese Civil War in 1947, quickly acceded, only informing Stalin afterward, much to the Generalissimo's surprise. Kim Il-sung was humiliatingly sidelined by Chinese commander Peng Dehuai, who had little respect for the North Korean leader and the mess he had made. Within 2 weeks, the Sino-Korean defense was able to fight enemy troops back over the 38th parallel, though the Chinese made it clear that they did not intend to go any farther south. Nevertheless, by the end of November, the North was able to retake Seoul. While the Chinese assistance has not been completely erased from subsequent domestic propaganda, it has certainly been minimized. General Douglas MacArthur, who was leading the UN command at the time, reacted to the Chinese entry into the war by ordering the entirety of the upper half of the peninsula, from the 38th parallel up to the Yalu River that marked the border with China, to be turned into a wasteland. The Americans decimated much of North Korea in aerial bombing raids, committing innumerable war crimes along the way by bombing dams that resulted in mass flooding of civilian infrastructure, and depleting drinking water reserves while raining napalm upon the population. Through these brutal attacks, the Allied lines below Seoul were able to regain force. In early April, the UN Army retook Seoul, and shortly thereafter, American ground forces were able to cross the 38th parallel once again, though they didn't get very far beyond it. At this point, roughly a year after the war had officially started, fighting stabilized at the 38th, though World War I-style trench warfare would continue for another 2 years, up until the 1953 ceasefire agreement, which left the border demarcating north and south almost exactly where it had been before. The war, which left millions of Korean, Chinese, and American soldiers and Korean civilians dead or wounded, was in the end a pointless tragedy. In a further absurdity, no peace treaty was ever signed. The two Koreas remain in a perpetual state of war. Today, you can visit the 160-mile-long demilitarized zone, DMZ, something of a misnomer since it's probably the most heavily militarized borderland in the world, with legions of soldiers and minefields surrounding either side, at the joint security area of Panmunjom, a truce village where North and South Korean soldiers stand face-to-face between two small blue houses meant to contain diplomatic exchanges between the DPRK and ROK governments. Your experience of the joint security area will be markedly different depending on which side you're visiting from. From the south, it must be done on a package tour, typically departing from Seoul, and is conducted with an air of high drama and deep paranoia, with participants rigorously briefed and made to sign a waiver acknowledging the possibility of injury or death as a result of enemy action. At the end of the trip, you are handed back the waiver to keep as a souvenir. One wrong move by a tourist, the South worries, could reignite the decades-long stalemate. U.S. soldiers, stationed at the base alongside their South Korean allies, inform you not to point or wave at the North Korean soldiers standing opposite the dividing line. Though there was only one on the day I visited, standing at the distant entrance to Panmunjom, the main North Korean building. The fear being that a waving tourist might be photographed by the North Koreans, only to have that wave transformed via the magic of Photoshop into an extended middle finger, which could then be used in yet another propaganda offensive against the South. Tourists are ordered to stand in a neat line, staring straight forward at the North Korean side, frown on the face and arms stuck to the sides, only to raise them to take photographs once the signal is given. Visiting from the North is almost comically relaxed by comparison. Of course, there are fewer tourists. You will usually be completely alone, save for the other members of your group, and even fewer visible soldiers. The bus leaves you at a souvenir shop in Panmunjom, where after doing your shopping, you are introduced to the single soldier who will be your guide and protector. He calmly accompanies you to the DPRK Peace Museum, which is in a reconstructed house that must resemble what the homes in Panmunjom looked like when it was a functional village, and is where the armistice agreement was signed on July 27, 1953. Here, the soldier guide somberly narrates the events leading up to and concluding that day. It's the North Korean version of the war, namely, the country's victimhood, having been led into a war it never wanted to fight by the U.S. aggressors, and its subsequent victory over them. Finally, you are led to the joint security area, where you are free to laugh, wave, or point at the South Korean side all you want. On my three visits to the DMZ on the North Korean side, I have never seen a single soldier standing on the ROK side. In fact, except for the smattering of soldiers standing guard on the northern half of the border, in bulky brown Korean People's Army uniforms, I can only imagine the envy they must feel when confronted by the stylish uniforms worn by their brethren from the south, with their ankle-high trousers, dark-lensed sunglasses, and black-and-white helmets. There was no human presence at the border. I found this surprising, as documentaries on the Korean conflict are always sure to include scenes shot at this precise location, with the enemy soldiers standing face-to-face, dramatically illustrating the peninsula's ongoing divide. Such a scene that led then-President Bill Clinton to deem the DMZ the scariest place on Earth. While the world was arguably a slightly less scary place back then than it is now, the only distressing thing nowadays is the barbed rhetoric spat forth on both sides. Once I asked my North Korean guide why there never seemed to be any soldiers standing in the ROK side of the divide. "They only come out when there are tourists," she said with a smile. "And it is the same on our side. When you leave, the soldiers will go away." Visiting from Seoul, I noticed North Korean items like bottles of soju for sale in the souvenir shop. And once, on the north side, I spied a soldier drinking from a can of that favorite imperialist beverage, Coca-Cola. All of which leads me to suspect that the two sides have managed to find a way to engage in some covert friendly trade. What was once a sensitive site where talks between the two sides might take place, eventually leading to a reconciliation, if not full reunification, then at least a peace treaty, has become a tourist site with the passage of time. The survival of all political systems relies, to greater and lesser extents, on the notion of a common enemy. This becomes solidified in the formation of national identity. In the United States in the past century, it has been communists, followed more recently by radical Islamists. In the left-wing dictatorships of the Second World during the Cold War era, the notion of an internal enemy, a citizen who looks like me and you, but is actually an enemy agent who has infiltrated the system to poison it ideologically from within, is one of the foundational myths of the paranoid totalitarian national psyche, and a charge that virtually anyone could stand accused of at any time. It is utilized as a tool for exercising total control over a populace, in the name of protection. Those governments, allegedly of and for the people, that abstract mass that is said to comprise, in North Korean lingo, a single-minded unity. With the exception of Kim Il-sung and his fellow Manchurian guerrillas, the founders of the North Korean state were by and large university-educated men and women whose intellectual formation could be traced to the canonical texts of socialism. Most had spent a good portion of their early lives abroad and were thus prone to combining a reasonable level of nationalist sentiment with a cosmopolitan worldview. Following Nikita Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin in 1956, the Soviet bloc launched campaigns against cults of personality, and many of these countries' leaders, who had opportunistically modeled themselves on the Generalissimo, now found themselves ousted from power in popular campaigns. This emboldened factions of the Workers' Party, including the Soviet Koreans, as well as the Yanin, Sino-Korean faction, to stand up against Kim Il-sung's increasingly despotic rule. These rival factions denounced and attempted to oust Kim from power in 1956, in what would come to be known as the August Incident. Kim had read the signs and knew what was coming. He had also been summoned to Moscow and given a dressing down by Khrushchev. And it was during that trip that his enemies at home planned the onslaught against him. It would take place at the already scheduled second plenary session of the Third Central Committee. The great leader had much to worry about. Prior to that moment, the Manchurian faction, composed of himself and his guerrilla comrades, was relatively weak in its quantitative representation in the Politburo. What's more, the Soviet and Yanin factions each had secured support from their respective powerful sponsors, countries that the comparatively weak DPRK still depended on financially, politically, and militarily. The signs of a coup were ominous. Upon his return from Moscow, Kim wasted no time. He invented a pretext to postpone the upcoming session for a month, giving him enough time to orchestrate a response and ensure the emergence of an army of loyalists within the Central Committee through a combination of intimidation, blackmail, and bribery. When the session finally took place and the combative factions commenced airing their grievances against the Suryong, for, among other charges, the foment of a cult of personality, the creation of a police state, the concentration of both state and party in his own hands, and the emphasis on the development of heavy industry that had resulted in mass starvation in rural areas among the largely peasant farmer populace, they were booed by the majority of Central Committee members. The Chinese and Soviet-backed factions of the North Korean political establishment were subsequently purged over the course of the next 2 years. Those replacing them in the most prominent positions of power were selected from the former guerrillas who had fought alongside Kim in his Manchuria days and tested sycophants. These men would oversee the development of the North Korean system as it has come to be today. Rather than the committed intellectuals of firm Marxist-Leninist pedigree, the new political elite comprised coarse, rugged ex-fighters, who could scarcely boast an elementary school education, many of whom were functionally illiterate, whose worldview, in stark contrast to the cosmopolitanism of their forebears, represented the plight of the simple peasant. Rather than regarding this as detrimental and shameful, the ideologues and intelligentsia of the DPRK would come to embrace this kind of simplicity as a redolent quality of the innocence and childlike goodness and purity supposedly endemic to all Koreans as a race. Emotionalism and jingoistic patriotism came to replace the sophistications of dialectical materialism and rational discourse. Hence, the continual intellectual impoverishment that persists in North Korea to this day. In the wider communist world, the late 1950s also saw another major drama play out in the form of the Sino-Soviet split. Already, the two red superpowers enacted very different forms of communism. As the Soviet Union became comparatively permissive and liberal after Stalin's demise, Maoist China was all about endless ideological mobilization and self-sacrifice to the cause and blind devotion to the great leader. North Korea, being a pre-modernized East Asian country where deference to authority was an inherent part of the Confucian tradition, was culturally much closer to China than it was to the USSR, and shared similar nationalist aspirations. In developing its own brand of socialism, Kim's DPRK borrowed heavily from the Maoist side, while shunning the relatively permissive culture of the post-Stalin Soviet Union. Despite his shaky relationship with Stalin, the Generalissimo remained Kim Il-sung's role model, and elements of Stalinism would be retained throughout his reign. In one respect, at least, Kim's cunning would far surpass that of his mentor. As the relations between China and the Soviet Union worsened over the years, rather than taking sides, North Korea would exploit the division between superpowers for all it was worth. Kim's tactic was to play the two off each other, ingratiating himself so as to reap aid from both countries, while fully taking the side of neither. Domestically, the DPRK distanced itself from both China and the Soviet Union in the development of its own ultra-nationalist ideology that would come to be known as Juche. The new elite had neither the intellect nor the experience to lead a fledgling country. They did, however, have one attribute that had, in the wake of the August incident, emerged as the single most important one in a country where all forms of political opposition had just been annihilated: an unbending obedience and loyalty to the great leader. When we finish bowing, I slide my sunglasses back over my eyes and retreat to inspect my favorite detail on Mansu Hill: the two sculptural groups on either side of the statues. One represents the armed struggle against the Japanese that led to the foundation of the country, while the second means to evoke the triumphant building of socialism, replete with a soldier trampling an American flag. These works, in contrast with the Kim statues, have been rendered in painstaking detail, and though they may belong to the much spat-upon socialist realist canon, there is something compelling in the evocations of persistence, hope, and anger etched into the faces of the soldiers, workers, and peasants who make up these relief-like groupings. A naturalness in their arrangement, clearly connoting struggle, and a fluid grace in the individual bodies forming the whole. What, precisely, are those Kim deifications smiling at? Turning your back to them to stare out at the same monumental vastness, made all the more dramatic by the steepness of the stairs one must climb to reach the statues from the street down below. One leg of the major downtown Pyongyang urban axis, extending across the Taedong River, becomes apparent. What the Kims are smiling at and regarding is not only the idyllic sight of the capital surrounding them, but one monument in particular situated on the other side of the Taedong River. If your vision is not good, you might need binoculars to fully appreciate it, as it is fronted with a vast green park exceeding 160,000 square feet. It culminates in a slightly smaller plaza, where rallies and mass dances are held, and finally, the monument itself. The three emblems making up the core body of the Workers' Party monument were built with granite blocks. The hammer stands for the worker, the brush for the intellectual, North Korea's unique contribution to the iconography of international socialism, with intellectual here being something of a catchphrase to include all white-collar officials, and the sickle connoting the farmer. The tripartite symbol is ringed by an outer belt, also made in granite, with a bronze inscription running across that reads, "The organizers of the victory of the Korean people and the leader of the Workers' Party of Korea." As with much monumental architecture and sculpture in the DPRK, its construction is loaded with numerological significance. In the case of the belt, for instance, it is made of 216 blocks and consists of an inner diameter of 42 meters. The birthday of Kim Jong-il, 2/16/1942. Beneath the monument, the circular foundation contains a 70-meter-long relief, meant to represent 70 years of the Workers' Party, including its dubious foundation as the Down with Imperialism Union, the organization that 14-year-old Kim Il-sung is said to have founded in Manchuria. As a stunning filler, two red flag-shaped apartment buildings have been erected on either side of the monument, crowned with the slogan, "Ever Victorious" in Korean. This is one of the more recent works of monumental sculpture in Pyongyang, having been unveiled in 1995 to mark the 50-year anniversary of the party's founding. As you turn back to face the Kims, a short path to the right of the Mansu Hill Grand Monument takes you to the Cholima statue, which overlooks, among other things, the Party Founding Museum, yet another line in the axial web that forms the Pyongyang city center. The Cholima is a winged horse that plays a prominent role in East Asian mythology. It is said to fly so swiftly and so elegantly that no mere mortal could ever mount it. The statue was erected in 1961 in celebration of the Cholima movement of 3 years prior. In that period of purges and increasing nationalization, Kim Il-sung again took a page from the Book of Stalin. Here, to the dismay of the rival factions who had deigned to express their outrage at Kim's intents on the development of heavy industry, to the detriment of the starving peasants who made up the majority of the population, Kim rebranded Stalin's Stakhanovite movement with a Korean face. The Cholima movement pushed industrial workers to achieve wildly ambitious overproduction targets by working double shifts, on a low-protein diet no less, and mobilizing students and office workers to volunteer their time in helping the nation to meet these goals. Despite the hyperbole surrounding the results of this push in the official history, the Cholima movement resulted in an excess of poor quality products, churned out at top-notch speed by a completely unskilled workforce and an exhausted, burnt-out populace. The term Cholima speed has assumed a permanent place in North Korean lingo and has set an unfortunate precedent in an economy in which speed and quantity are privileged over endurance and quality. In 2014, a recently completed apartment building in the capital collapsed, killing several residents, thanks to the slipshod construction and round-the-clock labor resulting from a campaign initiated by the latest Kim, Korea Speed. Chapter 8. After our morning at the empty monument, we go in search of people. Sunday is the official day off granted to North Koreans. And as it is stifling, the Munsu Water Park, opened to great pomp in November 2013, is packed with elated Pyongyangites, eager to cool off. In its splendor, size, and sheer quantity of amenities, Munsu Water Park would be the envy of any 10-year-old in the world. Arriving, we are greeted in the lobby with a wax statue of Kim Jong-il in his trademark khaki suit, high heels, and pompadours standing with a wide grin before a panoramic painting of a sandy beach shore. We complete the ritual of bowing to this unintentional comedic atrocity. Stifling a grin, I slowly raise my camera to take a photograph. Ro quickly waves his hand in front of me. No photos. No photos. At least someone is sensitive enough to perceive the camp value of this aesthetic eyesore. Encompassing a palatial 37 acres, the park contains countless indoor and outdoor slides of varied size and design, including a steep freefall where you race to the bottom on a raft while the waiting crowds below cheer you on. The outdoor pools are ringed by a lazy river with a gentle current that allows you to float or swim along, making for a cinematic people-watching extravaganza. Ro negotiates our entrance at the ticket desk before leading us into the changing room. The moment we walk in, the pungent stench of unwashed ass attacks my nostrils. Despite all the outward signs of luxury abounding in Pyongyang these days, toilet paper is still a rarity in most parts of the country, as is hot water, factors that tend to take their toll on personal hygiene. I try not to breathe as I quickly remove my clothes, stash them in my locker, put on my bathing suit, and head to the shower room. After showering off, we head to the swimming pool. A man trails after us, buck naked, thinking he's heading back to the changing rooms. He's clearly lost in some daze of introspection, because it's not until he's walked out into the middle of the packed water park, and everyone has turned to look at him, that he suddenly realizes where he is, turns around, and darts back into the shower room. Maybe he's looking for a wife, jokes Alexander. Ro doubles up with laughter. It's clearly the funniest thing he's seen for a long while. The three of us are the only foreigners in the entire place, providing a bonus sideshow for the giggling masses. If you're foreign, getting stared at constantly wherever you go is the norm in North Korea. You learn to ignore it, though you never quite get used to it. Everyone stares, but very few are willing to interact beyond that. One of the questions I am most often asked by people interested in my travels to North Korea is whether I am allowed to speak with ordinary people. While locals are discouraged from and often fearful of doing so, what most often prevents that from happening is shyness, or more usually, a lack of fluency in a language besides Korean. Alec, who doesn't swim, retreats with Min and Ro to grab a snack at one of the park's fast food restaurants, leaving Alexander and me to explore on our own. In the massive dry sauna, which, health and safety measures be damned, also includes a small baby pool with mothers and their toddlers splashing about, we stare through the open window at one of the indoor pools. You see that guy over there? Alexander points to an older gentleman walking around the edge of the pool with his arms held behind his back. He has his bathing suit on, but isn't wet, and doesn't appear to be interacting with any friends or family members. Rather, he's just walking back and forth, casually observing the scenery. There are guys like that everywhere. You begin to notice after a while. I've been watching him all day. Look, he's not swimming or doing anything. His job is just to watch people and report. Maybe not everyone, I whisper. Maybe just one person or family. You're right. He might not even be Boibu. The Boibu, or State Security Department,